I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
A series of coordinated attacks across Iraq today killed at least 69 people and wounded more than 270. Three American soldiers were among the dead. Police and government buildings in five cities were targeted. The group led by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi has claimed responsibility. Iraq's interim prime minister, Iyad al-Alawi, said the attacks were meant to foil the democratic process. They come less than a week before Iraqis assume control of their country. Joining us on the line from Baghdad is Vivian Walt, correspondent for Time magazine. She also writes for the Boston Globe. Vivian, what can you tell us briefly about these latest bombings?
Well, the most striking feature, Robin, is how coordinated it was. I mean, completely synchronized across hundreds of miles. We haven't seen this level of coordination for several months, and it does suggest that the Zarqawi network, although it's claiming total responsibility, clearly has significant coordination with old Saddam supporters and perhaps Republican Guard elements. This is what Prime Minister Alawi was talking about this afternoon, saying that what he could see is actually the tight coordination now between two elements of the insurgency.
Bombings in Baghdad, Fallujah, Bakuba, Mosul, and Ramadi. Musab al-Zarqawi, the Jordanian insurgent you're speaking of, is also believed to be behind the recent beheadings in Iraq. What is his agenda besides just upsetting the transfer of power?
Well, he certainly has a grander al-Qaeda-like vision. He has spoken several times about driving the infidels out of this Muslim country, about creating a kind of purist Islamic kind of country in Iraq. I mean, this is a moment at which the future of Iraq, the whole vision of what kind of country this is going to be, is really up for grabs very much. So in that sense, he is a very, very important player in this country at the moment. And he is not going away with this handover, even though the American occupation will end. Zarqawi's battle continues.
Well, he wants to drive the infidels, as you said, out. But what about Iraqis? They're being killed. Are they leaving? How are Iraqis reacting to the violence and the upcoming transfer?
Well, there's tremendous nervousness, Robin. I mean, I was out for a few hours this afternoon around Baghdad, and people were talking about closing down their shops for several days. This is something that they haven't done since the war. They say that they can foresee a level of violence which they have not experienced for now 15 months, nearly. And so there is a tremendous nervousness about the coming week. I think for most people, the transition itself has already happened, but obviously the June 30th date has tremendous symbolic value, if you like.
Well, they're closing up shops, but in the minute we have, I mean, are they able to leave? Would any Iraqis, you know, go to a neighboring country for a while? What are their options?
No, I don't think so. And we saw this during the war as well. Iraqis stay close to home, by and large. They might go to their traditional tribal areas outside the city, but otherwise not. They would, you know, guard their houses, guard their possessions, stay, you know, indoors and at home. That's generally the instinctual reaction.
And we just have a couple seconds, but has any U.S. official said to you privately or otherwise that the transfer may not happen?
I don't think that is a possibility. I think at this point the wheels are in motion. Nobody is really seriously considering scrapping the June 30th date. What you might just see is tremendous military action on that date. And don't forget, you know, we do have nearly 140,000 coalition troops here who are not going anywhere, Robin.
Vivian, thank you so much. Speaking to us from Baghdad, Vivian Walt, correspondent for Time magazine.
At least four people are now dead in Istanbul, Turkey today after a bomb exploded on a public bus in a residential neighborhood. A few hours earlier, another bomb went off in front of a hotel in Turkey's capital, Ankara, the same hotel where President Bush will be staying this weekend. He'll be in Ankara to meet with Turkish leaders before heading to Istanbul for a NATO summit. Hugh Pope reports on the region for the Wall Street Journal, and he joins us now on the line from Istanbul. Hugh, welcome. And what can you tell us about these two explosions? Is anyone claiming responsibility for them?
The explosion in Ankara has apparently been claimed by a small Marxist faction. And the bomb that went off in Istanbul was a similar kind of sand bomb, which is in Turkey is a bomb that usually makes a lot of noise and doesn't do much damage and goes off in the middle of the night. Unfortunately, in the case of the bomb on the bus in Istanbul, it appears to have been in a bag on the lap of a young woman just sitting behind the driver on the bus, and it seems to have gone off prematurely. And because it went off in such a confined space, it did all this terrible damage.
Well, obviously, the blast outside the hotel raises some big questions about security for President Bush's visit. What are officials saying about the kinds of security precautions that are being taken?
The security precautions are immense. As you can imagine, nothing would be more embarrassing than having an incident while the president was here. In Ankara, the whole area will be sealed off, and in Istanbul, they're even stopping the passage of tankers and ships down the Bosphorus waterway, one of the major waterways of the world, to make sure that nothing happens. So they're saying that basically that this shows that all these massive precautions we've been taking are meaningful, because it's got to such a point that there are people in Istanbul who are demanding that the whole country be given 3 days off, because it will be impossible to work with the number of streets and places that are going to be closed.
Now, Turkey has been fairly quiet since last November, when there were a series of coordinated terrorist attacks at several sites, including two synagogues. And I understand trials are currently underway for about 60 people involved in those attacks?
Yes, rather confused trials, since the court system has radically changed due to the exigencies of getting ready for European Union membership. But yes, they tracked those bombs in November down to a cell of Al-Qaeda that was connected with Afghanistan and so forth. I think the bombs we're dealing with now are a different kind of thing. I think that it was, as I said, I think it was probably a mistake that so many people were killed today by that bomb on the bus. And it may have seemed quiet from the United States, but these sound bombs have been coming up in the last few weeks as markers, if you like, from left-wing groups who are virulently opposed to NATO, virulently opposed to the current government as well. And they just wish to make it clear that they're there, that they're able to do something. I see no evidence at the moment that the Islamists let's not call them Islamists, or terrorists who wish to really strike big targets will be able to do very much, given the huge security precautions that Turkey's taking.
Mm. Well, Hugh, in the couple seconds we have left, are these two attacks seen as related?
Yes, I think that it was fair to see the same kind of bomb. They are a type of bomb that's well known, and I think that it's just a tragic mistake by the group involved, not to give them any credit, but I think that the fact that there are people injured is very unusual.
Mm. Hugh, thank you very much. Hugh Pope covers Turkey for The Wall Street Journal.
American diplomats at the UN yesterday dropped their fight to make U.S. troops exempt from war crimes prosecution at the International Court in The Hague. This is seen as a major retreat forced on the U.S. by the outcry over abuse at the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. At the same time, U.S. officials in Iraq are trying to forge a deal that would grant American personnel immunity from prosecution in Iraqi courts, even after power is handed over. Robin Wright is senior diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post. She joins us on the line from the Capitol. Robin, let's go to the U.N. first. The U.S. is not a signatory to The Hague. The court only tries those soldiers from countries that wouldn't try their own in their own courts anyway. So it's highly unlikely that any GI would ever be tried in The Hague anyway, correct?
That's right. And also, Iraq is not a signatory to this treaty, and so this would not apply to Iraq either. It is the principle, really, that's at stake here, and the psychology of it. The United States felt that it could get an automatic rollover of an agreement that has prevailed over the last 2 years, and it obviously and seriously miscalculated, in part because of the fallout after the Abu Ghraib atrocities.
Well, now let's turn to prosecutions in Iraq, which is a different thing altogether. Right now, under American rule, there's something called Order 17. That protects any American or other non-Iraqi working for the Americans from arrest or prosecution under Iraqi law. What is the U.S. trying to negotiate now as far as prosecution in Iraqi courts?
The issue is whether to give a blanket waiver for all acts, criminal or civil, by American troops. The current immunity covers everything for both troops and contractors who are not in the military and any American personnel involved in the coalition. The issue is whether everyone will be included in it and how much immunity. There are various degrees, various activities that could be brought under it, and the United States is looking for some middle ground so it doesn't look like it's giving itself a blank check to do whatever it wants in Iraq.
We should say, Robin, in theory, the U.S. will try its own soldiers for any crimes committed.
Absolutely. The United States would be the one to have jurisdiction over all American troops and personnel.
Yeah. This comes at a sticky time when there's a perception already in place that the U.S. isn't really handing over power.
That's right. And one of the problems, of course, is the new interim Iraqi leadership could extend some kind of immunity, but it would also endanger its credibility in the eyes of many Iraqis. And so this would be a very awkward act as one of the first actions by a new government. And so the United States is trying to get around that by issuing or extending this order itself.
But there's a history of this question of immunity. I'm thinking of the 60s.
Absolutely. Very good point, Robin. This has been a very sensitive issue because back in the 1960s, Ayatollah Khomeini, the founder and leader of Iran's revolution, came to fame during the Johnson administration when Washington demanded that Iran issue immunity for some 40,000 American troops in Iran. Ayatollah Khomeini charged this was terribly unfair to Iranians. That issue led to a split between Khomeini and the Shah of Iran, and Khomeini's eventual exile. He was deported. And, of course, he ended up in Iraq, in Najaf, the Shiite holy city. And this is an issue that really resonates among Muslims and is very familiar to Iraqis and Iranians.
And yet, just in the few seconds we have, to be fair, it's a difficult call because it would be, I would think, untenable for the U.S. to put its soldiers in the position of being arrested and charged for killing Iraqis while they're serving in Iraq.
Absolutely. And, in fact, it's the best alternative of a lot of bad options, which is why the United States has decided to move ahead on this one.
Robin, thank you.
Thank you.
Robin Wright, senior diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post.
Just ahead, journalist Seymour Hirsch says some Pentagon advisors are using a book from 30 years ago to set policy in Iraq today. The author's daughters say it's a misuse of his work.
And later, the Supreme Court says a lower court should decide whether the names of Vice President Cheney's energy advisors should be made public.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
A book published 30 years ago on how Arabs think is in the news these days after it was mentioned by Seymour Hirsch in a New Yorker magazine article last month. The book is called The Arab Mind, and it was written by a scholar now dead named Rafael Patai. Hirsch claimed that top Pentagon officials, the so-called neocons, had taken the book as their Bible on Arab culture and found in it justification for, among other things, the interrogation techniques used in Abu Ghraib prison in Baghdad. Well, Patai's daughters took issue with that conclusion and have gone public with a spirited defense of their father and his book. We spoke with Daphne Patai, who teaches comparative literature at UMass Amherst.
My father never in any way suggested or wrote or had in mind that anyone should or could humiliate an Arab by engaging in particular types of behavior. He has far more pages on Arabic as a language and on Arabic literature than he does on sexuality. And he was a great admirer of Arabic and Arabic literature. is his book being used by neocons? Who knows? I do know that it's used by the military, and I certainly hope that lots of good scholarly books are used by the military. I certainly hope that they're not sending people to other parts of the world who are completely ignorant of that part of the world.
Well, joining us from Washington to talk about the book and the firestorm that has flared up around it is Tamara Kaufman-Wittes, a research fellow at the Brookings Institution and a Middle East scholar. Tamara, thanks for being with us.
Hello.
What can you tell us about this book? It was written in the early 70s. It's now become something of a whipping post, his daughters say unfairly. Are you familiar with it?
Yes. In fact, I taught it as a teaching assistant when I was in graduate school at Georgetown.
And how would you characterize it? Is it a good book, bad book, what?
Well, it's a fascinating book. I guess I would best describe it as quaint. It seems like something from an earlier era of scholarship. It's rooted in the idea that you can learn something about a culture by looking at the way it rears children and other basic rules of community behavior, so that if child-rearing practices are shared widely across a community, then that should deeply affect the behavior and the personality of the people who grow up in that community. And therefore, you can describe something called a national character or a mind based on those early experiences that are shared across the community.
Well, one of the reasons why this has become controversial is a Seymour Hersh article in The New Yorker about a month or so ago, in which he quotes an academic as saying that the Patai book had become the Bible of the neocons on Arab behavior because of two primary themes. One, that Arabs only understood force, and two, that the biggest weakness of Arabs was shame and humiliation. And I wonder if you agree with that, and is there any evidence for it?
Well, I don't know, and Hersh doesn't provide in his article any direct evidence that this is, in fact, the Bible for the neocons. Certainly within Middle Eastern studies, it's not a widely read or widely taught text. And in fact, I didn't encounter it in my Middle East studies work. I encountered it in a course on introductory international relations where it was used to teach students about what was good social science and what was bad social science. And it was an example of overgeneralization. So I don't think it could be considered an authoritative text. But I have to also take issue with the characterization of the book in Cy Hersh's article. I don't recall anything in there that says that Arabs only understand force. In fact, it's an incredibly complex and rather sympathetic portrayal of Arab culture, and it talks a lot about tendency to bluster and exaggeration in language, but certainly not about the need to use force. And while it does discuss Arab culture as a shame culture, and I might say that that's something many traditional cultures are characterized as, I don't think it could be said to recommend the use of shame or humiliation to control Arabs. If anything, the book ends with an argument about the need for Western countries and Western governments to better understand Arab culture if they want to help Arab states and societies join the modern world.
And are you sympathetic with the daughters' attempts now to clear their father's name?
You know, it strikes me as implausible, first, that any one book would become the basis of a policy in such a direct fashion. Second, that senior neoconservative intellectuals inside and outside the administration would have direct influence on our interrogation policies at a prison in Iraq. And thirdly, it really strikes me that the kinds of abusive behaviors that were inflicted on the prisoners there are things that any adolescent-minded, power-hungry prison guard could come up with as a way to humiliate a fellow human being. It doesn't seem to me culturally specific in the least.
Why has this book then become the center of so much attention now in your world, in the world of Middle East studies?
Well, this allegation about Patai's book comes in the context of a really large and brewing battle between Middle East studies experts of the left and the right. more neoconservative elements within the Middle East studies world criticize the bulk of the academic specialists on the region for being apologists for radicalism in the region and opponents of American policy. And there's actually a proposal in Congress right now to create an oversight board to oversee the use of government money in all area studies programs. And that comes out of this neoconservative displeasure with the state of Middle Eastern studies. And so the idea that neoconservatives were making use of Pattai's book fell perfectly into place in the picture of this battle between neoconservatives and the academy that works on Middle East issues.
Tamara, thank you.
Thank you.
Tamara Kaufman-Wittes is a research fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, it's been talked about and talked about. Finally, it's in theaters. We'll review Fahrenheit 9/11. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The Supreme Court today refused to order the release of details of Vice President Dick Cheney's energy task force, sending the case back to a lower court. The justices said the lower court should spend more time reviewing the case to decide whether the federal open government law could be used to compel the Bush administration to make the energy task force documents public. Well, joining us on the line is Emory University Law Professor Robert Shapiro. And Professor Shapiro, could you remind us briefly, what was the Cheney case about?
Well, in some sense, it was really about balancing the public's right to information against the president's need for candid and confidential advice. The actual case concerned the National Energy Policy Task Force, which President Bush appointed soon after coming into office and was chaired by Vice President Dick Cheney. Now, a lot of groups really wanted access to the records of that task force to find out with whom people were meeting and what was done at the meetings. And there is a federal law, the Federal Advisory Committee Act, which says that advisory committees do have to turn over that kind of information. However, the real technical issue here was that that law doesn't apply if all members of the task force are government officials. So what the plaintiffs in this case wanted was the chance to prove that some people who were private parties essentially were members of the task force, which would then open it up to public scrutiny.
So it's an argument about which law applies and what does the law mean. In the meantime, who wins today because the Supreme Court has sent it back to a lower court?
Well, certainly it's an initial win for Vice President Dick Cheney. What the Supreme Court said was that the lower court really should be more deferential to the vice president in looking at this matter. That is, the plaintiffs, in this case a kind of odd combination of the Sierra Club, an environmental group, and Judicial Watch, a conservative watchdog group, they had said, well, they needed lots of information about what went on in the committee so they could prove that this federal open government law applied. And what the Supreme Court said was when that claim was being looked at, the lower court should take very seriously the need for confidential advice being given to the president.
Isn't this also a victory in part, as some are saying, for the Bush administration? Because this now means that whatever information is there will definitely not come forward before the election because of the time involved now.
Absolutely. And there were some thoughts that some of the information might be a bit embarrassing. That is, it's alleged that Enron executives and others were very close to the operation of this committee. And what the lower court had suggested was that some information would need to be turned over right away. And this decision certainly will delay that until after the election.
And Professor Shapiro, this is the case we should remind people that Justice Scalia got into a little bit of hot water over because of a duck hunting trip.
Yes, exactly. While this case was being considered, Justice Scalia ended up going on a duck hunting trip with Vice President Cheney, which then elicited a very unusual 20-page explanation by Justice Scalia of why going duck hunting with the vice president shouldn't disqualify him from the case.
And he stayed on the case. I happen to have a part of that here. He wrote, "If it is reasonable to think that a Supreme Court justice can be bought so cheap," meaning by a duck hunting trip, "the nation is in deeper trouble than I had imagined." And he decided to stay on the case.
Absolutely. And in fact, it was a 7-2 decision. But Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas wrote separately to say that they thought that there should be even more deference given to the government and to Vice President Cheney than the rest of the justices were willing to give.
So now after today's, as you said, 7-2 decision, it goes back to the lower court. In just a few seconds, we have any sense of how long it will take to get on the docket again?
Well, I think first it has to go down to the Court of Appeals to review this and then back to the district court. So it's always hard to predict, but I think it's going to be several months at least, and I think it's unlikely the administration will have to hand over anything before the election.
Professor Shapiro, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Professor Robert Shapiro teaches law at Emory University. He spoke to us from Atlanta.
New poll numbers are suggesting that independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader may once again be the spoiler in the November election, drawing enough votes from Democrats to seal the re-election of George Bush. And that has put Nader firmly in the hot seat. Yesterday, two Democrats in Arizona sued to keep him off the ballot there. And on Tuesday, the Congressional Black Caucus didn't mince words in a meeting with the presidential candidate. Reporters outside the meeting room could hear shouting. Congresswoman Carolyn Kilpatrick of Michigan apparently told Nader to, quote, get his ass out of the race. And she wasn't alone in her sentiments. Here's what Nader had to say in an interview with NPR's Tavis Smiley.
Some of them used very abusive language. I mean, Congressman Watts of North Carolina used such abusive language that I could hardly believe he was saying what he was saying.
Well, Congressman Melvin Watt of North Carolina joins us on the line from Washington. And, Congressman, what did you say to Ralph Nader?
Well, let me first say that I'm extremely distressed to be having a public discussion about something that occurred in a private meeting. And we get about one-third through the meeting and realize that Mr. Nader's people are tape recording the meeting without having discussed any of it. So we had an exchange about that. That didn't create the most friendly kind of atmosphere. And then to hear him yesterday is even more distressing to me. So ordinarily, I wouldn't even be having a public discussion about this, but since he called out Congressman Watts, that's not me, but it'd been nice if he would have at least have known my name.
Right, which is Watt.
Right. So let me just be clear that I didn't think I used abusive language at all. It was clear that I was trying to be honest with him, because I thought this was a private meeting. And I wanted him to know that I could not go back into my community and tell my constituents that his candidacy was anything other than an arrogant ego trip. And so I said that to him in no uncertain terms. And
probably not what he wanted to hear.
It was not what he wanted to hear, but I don't think it was abusive. I just wanted to make it clear to him what I would be saying to my constituents about his candidacy, and that I was offended that he would walk into a room of Congressional Black Caucus members and try to explain to us what was in the interests of black people. I thought it was arrogant, condescending, and offensive, and I told him that.
Although in the past, Nader has enjoyed a cordial or, as Tavis Smiley put it, even effusive relationship with many African-American politicians. So why do you think he would risk that?
Well, I don't know. I think he was well aware in advance of what the sentiments of the members of the Congressional Black Caucus were. We think the stakes are too high, and we could end up with George Bush being president of the United States for four more years.
Do you think he heard you on that point?
No. I think his arrogance and his ego won't allow him to hear anything other than what his opinion is, and that's what this candidacy is about.
Congressman, thank you.
Thank you.
Congressman Melvin Watt represents North Carolina's 12th District. He joined us on the line from Washington.
Still to come, Lollapalooza goes dark. Its fans, it seems, are just getting older.
You're listening to Here and Now.
It's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
But first, this correction. In our segment yesterday about the investigation into who leaked the name of CIA operative Valerie Plame, we said that Washington Post reporter Glenn Kessler agreed to testify in front of a grand jury. We should have said Kessler submitted to a taped interview, which will be provided to the grand jury.
Last week, we talked about the 9/11 hearings with intelligence expert James Bamford, author of Pretext for War. Bamford, noting the panel's findings on the confusion in U.S. agencies during the attacks, spoke of how unprepared the U.S. was to intercept the hijacked planes and shoot them down. This prompted Pat Daly of Churchville, Pennsylvania, to write, "What nation on earth stood ready to shoot down its own civilian airliners prior to September 11th? Had your program learned prior to September 11th of a squadron of American fighter jets that was trained and stood ready to intercept and shoot down American civilian airliners within minutes of a hijacking, yours would have been the first program to condemn this as another outlandish and dangerous policy of the government. And we would all have agreed. It's easy to take cheap shots when hindsight gives you 20/20 vision."
Last week, President Bush and Vice President Cheney differed with the 9/11 panel findings regarding the relationship, ties, or links between Saddam Hussein and the al-Qaeda network, a topic we took up with Andrea Stone of USA Today and Jonathan Alter of Newsweek. Both Alter and Stone said that the White House left a public perception that Saddam Hussein was involved in the 9/11 attacks, which prompted this call from Dan Lapp of Foxborough, Massachusetts.
Here and Now just had a report where they interviewed two reporters who were anti-Bush. It seems to me that you, that WBUR and Here and Now should make an effort to get both sides of the story. Even if WBUR disagrees that there are two sides to the story, there obviously are many people who think there are two sides.
Our interview with former Talking Heads musician David Byrne about his foray into opera on his latest CD brought this comment from Michael Ellis of Springfield, Pennsylvania. "I left the room during today's broadcast and returned to hear the Byrne destruction of the unbelievably lovely duet from the Bizet opera, The Pearl Fishers. Every second was torture beyond any thought up by the U.S. military." Well, you can't please all the people and all the opera lovers all the time.
And finally, during our interview with Stephen Talty, author of Mulatto America, a book that looks at the convergence of black and white America, we asked if the next great cross-pollination might be with Latino America. Well, Maria Calls Vidal of Charlotte, North Carolina, wrote to point out that that's already happened, and she gives us some examples. Maria writes, "I will start with one of the quintessential American sitcoms of all time, I Love Lucy, where Desi Arnaz played a blend of Afro-Cuban music with American big band sound, and many times added lyrics in English. How mulatto can you get? Also popular in the 50s and early 60s was the mambo music of Damaso Perez Prado, and the great Dizzy Gillespie through the years incorporated Afro-Cuban music with American jazz, as in his classic composition, Manteca."
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. And please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
This news note, President Bush was interviewed this morning in the Oval Office by federal prosecutors in connection with the investigation into who leaked the name of an undercover CIA agent to the news media. The president was questioned for 70 minutes by U.S. Attorney Patrick Fitzgerald, who is heading up the Justice Department's investigation. The president has already hired a private attorney to represent him in the matter. Investigators want to know who identified Agent Valerie Plame to syndicated columnist Robert Novak last summer. Plame is the wife of former ambassador and Bush administration critic Joseph Wilson. Disclosure of an undercover agent's name can be a federal crime.
Stem cell research had been pushed off the national radar by the war in Iraq and terrorism, but it was promptly brought back into focus by the death of Ronald Reagan, who long suffered from Alzheimer's disease, a disease that many say could be helped by stem cell research. This week, Britain's Cambridge University announced it will open a $30 million stem cell research center, described as the largest in the world. And new legislation in the U.S. House of Representatives seeks to expand funding for stem cell research in this country. But what are the odds of that happening? Joining us on the line is Rick Weiss of The Washington Post. Rick, as we understand, the bill in the House would make federal funding available for research using only excess embryonic stem cells. These are embryos donated by fertility clinics. They're leftovers that were going to be thrown away anyway, not created for the purpose of extracting stem cells. So that would seem to please people on both sides of the debate. But why is this not a shoo-in?
Well, that certainly is the path that has probably the most chance of getting anywhere, at least in the longer term, because there are something like 400,000 frozen embryos in this country left over from fertility treatments, and almost all of them eventually going to be destroyed. But for those who feel that even a frozen embryo is a is an entity with great moral standing and should not be destroyed for any purpose, there are concerns that if nothing else, the desire to do research on them might create an incentive among the parents of these embryos to destroy them where they might otherwise someday use them, donate them, or leave them frozen forever, which leaves them at least in a suspended moral status.
Remind us of President Bush's executive order on stem cell research and federal funding for such research, and remind us of the criticism of it.
Right. Well, you know, back, it's hard to remember this, but in August of 2001, when he made this executive order, stem cells was the hottest thing on the national agenda. It was his first televised presentation to the entire nation, and it was just about stem cells. And he said, fine, if you want to do research on stem cell lines that have already been created by now, we'll support that with federal dollars. But federal dollars will not be used to destroy additional embryos and make new stem cell lines. Now, the problem was that at the time, he said there were something like 60-plus such stem cell lines available for research. As it has turned out, there were far fewer. There's 19 right now available, and all of those have been contaminated in laboratory dishes with mouse tumor cells as the way they were grown, something that's no longer done with newer stem cell lines in use in other countries. And so the feeling very much among scientists in this country is that there aren't enough to work with, and those that are available are not going to be really useful for transplantation into human patients.
In fact, this new center that I mentioned in Cambridge, England, has as a founding professor a man who left the University of California after President Bush's ban on federally funded laboratories. Do you expect that one of the side effects of that ban is that we're going to see this exodus of American stem cell researchers overseas?
It's certainly one of the concerns that's been raised by proponents, and it might be that a few people will leave. I actually don't believe there'd be a major exodus, but I do believe that a related phenomenon may happen, and already is happening, which is that researchers in other countries where it is allowed and encouraged, including not only England, but Australia, Singapore, South Korea, are going to make major advances where researchers in this country will not. And that's not only a matter of national pride, but of intellectual property and patent production, and who's going to really own and advance these technologies in the future.
Rick Weiss, thank you.
You're welcome.
Rick Weiss is a reporter for The Washington Post. Lollapalooza, the touring festival founded 13 years ago by Jane's Addiction frontman Perry Farrell, has been canceled. The lineup read like a who's who of alternative rock: Morrissey, Sonic Youth, The Flaming Lips, PJ Harvey. The reunited Pixies were even going to make appearances in New York. So why were ticket sales so poor? Gary Bongiovanni is editor-in-chief of Pollstar, a weekly trade magazine and website that covers the concert business. He joins us from his office in Fresno, California. Gary, what up? What happened here?
Well, Robin, the concert business is more art than science, and I think what happened was that Perry Farrell and the Lollapalooza organizers put together a package of talent that probably really appealed to them and looked great on paper, but when it was offered to the public in the format that it was offered, that it wasn't something that people were interested in spending money on.
Specific people, the 16-year-olds, is that what you're saying, that the audience that they needed to get was younger than the show they'd plan?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at all the artists on the bill, you know, most of them have been around 5 or 10 years or more and are not likely to be in the top five most listened to artists for your average 17, 18-year-old. And when it comes to spending 8 hours in the sun listening to a dozen bands, your core audience tends to be young teenagers, mm-hmm. and maybe not your aging Morrissey or Sonic Youth fans. You know, if you're a PJ Harvey fan, maybe you'd rather see her in a theater environment at some other point.
That's right. I mean, it's so interesting because you're talking about an aging fan, but they might be, 25, 30.
Yeah, I mean, we're still, you know, it's probably younger than the main part of the baby boomer generation, and the fans probably still keep their musical interests, but, you know, because of lifestyle changes and just getting older, you're not willing to put your body through 12 hours of socializing out in the sun to see that many bands.
There are other festivals that have been terrifically successful. I'm thinking of Coachella in California, and is it called Bonnaroo? That's the jam band festival in Tennessee.
Right. Those have both been very successful, but those are different. Those are destination festivals. They're not touring the country. If you're a fan of that kind of music, then you go out there and you camp out, and you know you're there for the entire experience.
Yeah, and I'm wondering too, is part of the problem that these bands that were so alternative so many years ago aren't really that alternative anymore? Is that what you're saying as well?
You know, I think what's really happened is what made Lollapalooza successful and unique when it first came out was the fact that it was so different. Since that time, we've seen a number of other touring festivals, Warped Tour, Ozfest, you know, the Sarah McLachlan's tour came and went. I mean, there's been any number of them. You put that together with the increasing number of radio station-sponsored festival shows where you're giving the public 15 or 20 acts at a bargain ticket price, and it kind of takes away from what Lollapalooza originally was. And, you know, they were off the scene for, 5 or 6 years? You know, that's an eternity in teenage years. Mm-hmm. And they really kind of had to reestablish the brand. You know, when they brought Lollapalooza back last year, I think the media made a bigger deal about it because they tended to be a little older than your average music fan and probably remembered Lollapalooza. I mean, the one thing last year did was it reestablished the brand in the marketplace for younger kids, but it takes more than that to be successful year after year.
So, Gary, what are you saying? Are we in the media old and out of step? is that what I'm hearing?
Well, no. You know, there's a difference between, you know, what you like as great music and what you can sell commercially at a given price. And until you put something on sale and ask the public to vote with their wallets, you never really know whether it's something that people are going to be receptive to.
That's right.
And price really wasn't an issue with Lollapalooza because they were very reasonable at their prices. It's just that in an overcrowded concert market like we have during the summer, you know, people got to make choices.
Well, Gary, thank you so much for weighing in on the end of Lollapalooza.
Thanks, Robin.
Gary Bongiovanni, editor-in-chief of Pollstar, a weekly trade magazine and website that covers the concert business. PJ Harvey, she was part of Lollapalooza's lineup. This song, You Come Through, is from her new CD, Her. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Crudell, Emiko Tamagawa, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Ian Hughes. Our web producer is Zach Christo, and our interns are Nick Weiss Richmond and Alexis Delvicio.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio
and join us again. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.